Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
We're very excited tonight to have A. Scott Berg here with his much-anticipated new biography, Wilson. Scott Berg has written four award-winning biographies. The first started as his thesis at Princeton University, Max Perkins, Editor of Genius, and won the National Book Award. Then he went on to receive a Guggenheim Fellowship to write Goldwyn, a biography. His third book, Lindbergh, won the Pulitzer Prize. And following that, he wrote a biographical memoir about Katharine Hepburn called Kate Remembered. And now with Wilson, he is already receiving rave reviews. After more than 10 years of research and writing, Wilson is the most personal and riveting story of our 28th president, who still stands as one of the most influential figures of the 23rd century. Oh, dear. 20th century. That was out of nowhere. The 20th century. And without further ado, will you please join me in welcoming Scott Berg?
Thank you. Thanks. Thanks for being here. And indeed, thank you for supporting bookstores and independent bookstores in particular that hold a place in all of our hearts. You've heard a little about what I do and what I've been doing, but I thought I should just give a little more explanation before I talk about Woodrow Wilson as to how and why I ended up spending 13 years, in fact, writing this book. And my first book was indeed about Max Perkins. It did start as my senior thesis in college. And while I was writing that book, I was 2 years into it, actually, and I began to think, wouldn't it be interesting not just to write a biography, but mightn't it be interesting to write a shelf full of biographies of 20th century American cultural figures? And each of the subjects of my book, I thought, at age 22, would be from a different part of the country, and each subject might be from a different wedge of the apple pie that is American culture. And so after I finished Max Perkins, who was an East Coast Harvard-educated ninth-generation white Anglo-Saxon Protestant, I began to think of the opposite of Perkins in almost every way. And I ended up writing about a first-generation Jewish immigrant, a teenage runaway from Warsaw, an illegal alien, in fact, whose name was Shmuel Gelbfish, who went to the West Coast, changed his name to Samuel Goldwyn, and invented something we now call Hollywood. For my third book, I went to the Midwest. I was looking for a metaphor of 20th century America rather the way the motion picture camera had been. And of course, I kept thinking of the airplane. Who was the most romantic embodiment of the airplane? Lindbergh. All roads kept leading to St. Louis and its spirit. And so that became the subject of my third book. And parenthetically, I did a memoir, really, about my friend of 20 years, Katharine Hepburn, whom, upon my meeting her, not immediately, but I would say we had known each other 2 days, when she said, you know, you really should write about me. Yes, okay, right. Because, she said, I'm fascinating, you know. And you know what? She was. And you know what? I did. And she always asked for me, actually, not just to write about her, but to publish something as close to her death as possible, which I also did, because the book came out within 2 weeks of her death. But then it was back to my plan, my apple pie, if you will. So I was looking for a fourth subject. I had never written about a Southerner. I had not written about somebody from politics and government, and for that matter, another important component of American culture. I had never written about somebody from higher education. And so I sat down with my publisher to discuss what my next book would be. I went through a list of possible subjects, but I said, I've had one subject in my hip pocket since I was 15 years old. And I said, when I was 15, I read a thin biography about Woodrow Wilson. And I said, I've been hooked on Wilson ever since. At 15, I put his poster up on my wall. And I said, I'm sure I was the only kid on the block with Woodrow Wilson up on the wall. And I didn't check, but I still think I probably was. But I mentioned the idea of Wilson to my publisher, and she said she loved the idea. She had always loved Wilson. She wanted to know much more about him. And so here we are tonight. And I should tell you that it is true that really since I was 15, Wilson has been a major part of my life in a lot of ways. I've always had that poster wherever I have lived. It has gone with me. I've almost always had a book about Wilson, whatever is the latest thing being written about him, certainly on my shelf, but usually close to my bed. And one of the major reasons I went to Princeton was because Woodrow Wilson had been there for so many years in his life. So I've been with Wilson for most of my life, certainly my entire adult life. So here we are tonight to talk about this book. That's the how and why I got into it. Now, I had some notions about Wilson when I got into it, but here are, in fact, well, two planks of my platform that I'm going to run on tonight. And these are two, well, they're sort of planks, but they're almost going to be threads that are going to run through this fabric that I call Woodrow Wilson now. But here are two themes that ran through my last 13 years of study and certainly run through the book. And there are two points I'd like to make tonight, and you can argue with them, and I hope in the next few minutes I might be able to explain them. If not, I think my book amply illustrates them, and if not then, that's too bad. This, frankly, is the best I can do. Here they are. I think Woodrow Wilson was, in fact, the most influential figure of the 20th century. And second, I think Woodrow Wilson's story, his personal life, his personal story, is the most dramatic story that has ever unfolded in the White House. And this, to me, in some ways, was the impetus for my writing the book. In some ways, this is the most important thing I tried to do in the book. Of the hundreds of works that have been written about Wilson, indeed thousands, but I've certainly read many, many hundreds, maybe thousands. But of them all, I had never seen a single book that I felt captured this man's emotional life, his psyche, what really went into who he was. And this is something I try to do in my biographies anyway, which is make these people come to life. These great subjects are more than just subjects. They're more than just historical figures. They're more than icons. These are flesh and blood people who lived. And Wilson, I knew, even before I dove into this book, I knew Wilson was extremely passionate, extremely emotional, and I knew that thread running through my fabric was going to inform, was going to rub against, was going to become the real meshing device against all the other historical stuff. So that is ultimately why I wrote this book. So because time obviously is limited and because I've said almost everything I have to say in the book, I wanted to give you a sample, though, of what happens within this life and within this book. So the best I can do in the next few minutes, I think, is give you a few bullet points, give you some take-home points that I hope you'll remember whether you read the book or not, but you will see how they do shine throughout the book. The first is this. Woodrow Wilson was the first Southerner elected to the presidency since the Civil War. Now, this was extremely important because the Civil War was obviously the most divisive event that ever happened to the United States. It will almost certainly be the most divisive event that ever happens to it. And Woodrow Wilson was born in 1856 in Virginia. So that's pre-Civil War. His very first memory, when he is not quite 4 years old, in November of 1860, his father was a Presbyterian minister who had moved from Wilson's birthplace in Virginia down to Augusta, Georgia. And Wilson's first memory in Georgia in life was one November day. Well, it was the Tuesday after the first Monday, in which he remembers a lot of hubbub outside the house. And he went outside. He's 3.5 years old. And everyone is saying, Lincoln got elected. There's going to be a great war. Now, most books don't even mention this or make anything of this. I think it's an extremely important, telling, and compelling point about Wilson, because he felt it was. He took it with him all his life. Most people who have written about Wilson don't tell you that he was really rather scarred by the Civil War. And even though he was a child, he was old enough, cognitive enough, to pay attention to what was going on. And over the next few years, as war did break out, Wilson saw how devastating war could be to a country. He saw his father's church turned into a hospital. He saw neighbors come home maimed. He saw a number of neighbors who never did come home. He saw the deprivation, the privation that his neighbors, his family, underwent during the 4 years of the war. When his family moved to Columbia, South Carolina, he saw a city that was half burned out. I mean, it was still in charge, you know. He saw all that, and he remembered all that, and he took that with him. And it's going to be one of those great personal events that's going to travel all the way into his presidency. And I'll hit that in a moment when I talk about the American entry or not entry into the First World War. But he took this event with him, and he never forgot it. Now, Wilson was also the most educated president we ever had. After growing up in the South, Wilson went north to college. He went to the College of New Jersey in Princeton, New Jersey, which later changed its name to Princeton. And there he was. He was a very good student. He did very well. The best work he did, in fact, was not in the classroom, but out of the classroom. And I mean not just extracurricular activities in which he excelled. He was just amazing. He had his finger in every pie on this campus, from running the athletic teams to starting debating societies. And wherever he went, he started a club. He was just a natural born leader. But the second thing, and the most important thing he got out of Princeton, was doing a lot of independent work, a lot of reading and writing on his own. And in fact, within a few weeks of his graduation from Princeton in 1879, his first article was published on politics, in fact. And it was published in a rather prestigious New England journal, where ironically, and if you know the end of the story, you'll see how ironic, his editor in this journal was a young Bostonian who was just contemplating a run for political office himself, named Henry Cabot Lodge. And of course, it's just one of the great ironies of history that they should have run into each other at the very beginning, and boy, do they run into each other at the end. And they did. So Wilson already was entertaining political dreams of his own. While he was in college, his ambition was certainly at least to become a senator, and probably something beyond that. So he sort of doped things out. He realized most people in politics were also lawyers, and he also realized that most of America's presidents, in fact, had been born in Virginia, and as had he. And so he enrolled at the University of Virginia Law School, studied law. As soon as he finished that, he decided he would open a practice in Atlanta, Georgia, which was really rebounding after the Civil War and Reconstruction. And he went down to Atlanta, opened an office with a friend, and there he proved to be a truly terrible lawyer. I mean, he could not have been worse. And I say that unqualifiedly, because in his year or two down there, he had no clients. I mean, zero. He didn't have a single client. He just read and wrote a lot of political articles, submitted them to the newspapers, sent them to journals, and so forth. Clearly, that's where his heart was. He did have one client, actually. He got one job while he was there, and that was his mother, who had just inherited some property, and she needed some legal papers drawn up. So she threw the job to her boy, and who also then had to go to the neighboring town of Rome, Georgia. So this Presbyterian minister's son went to Rome, where he met, wouldn't you know, the Presbyterian minister's daughter. And he fell instantly in love with her. And as you'll see in the book, she was a beautiful girl, very talented, very well-read, really instantly in love with her, and wanted to marry her right off the bat. The problem, of course, was he had no job, he had no career, he had no promise of either. And so this leads to two points. The first is he decided to follow his heart in two ways. The first was he began to think he really didn't have a shot at a political career. He was down in Atlanta. He never obviously didn't make a dent there. He realized to get ahead in politics, especially in the rather corrupt late 19th century, you needed money and or you needed some family name, some prestige, some power somehow. He had neither. So the heart he decided to pursue here was what was the thing he loved most after politics, and that was education. And so he decided to pursue a career in education. The second thing, though, and this is sort of a dream for the biographer, Wilson, because it was going to be a couple of years before he was going to be trained enough to make a living in education, began courting Ellen Louise Axon, as was the girl's name, through the mail. And he and she embarked upon a correspondence for the next 3 years. That is, I think, the most passionate correspondence that has ever been committed to paper. I mean, these two people wrote thousands of love letters to each other. Now, let me rephrase this for you. They wrote thousands of love letters. Some of them go on for 15 pages. You know, he's writing, you know, how much he loves her. And then at the end of the day, at the end of the letter, he mails that. And then later he'll write another letter. Same thing, going on and on and on, all this passionate sentiment. I mean, these letters were sickening. There were days when I would go through Wilson's papers and I said, please, no love letters today. There's nothing left to say. You love the girl. I got it. Marry her, you know. But no, they go on for pages and months and years. And she actually gave as good as she got. She wrote back pretty good herself. So there they were. And this became extremely important to me again in putting this book together. And it's not just to tell the story of this really lovely love story, which it is, but it's to say that here's a young man who is so passionate that he commits every emotion, not just his thoughts, but he's so uninhibited in expressing emotion. And this is a 19th century male, you know, and that was pretty extraordinary. And there it all is. And once again, this is going to be a great thread, you see, that goes throughout history, Wilson's history and the history of the country. And you will see, or I certainly saw, how the passion of Wilson really kept informing the professional decisions, the political decisions he made in such a way that I had not seen any of that in a biography of Wilson, or for that matter, of any president. So that became important to me. So Wilson, anyway, wanting to get married, wanting to raise a family, enrolls as a graduate student at Johns Hopkins. He becomes one of the first students in a brand new field in this country, what we call political science. And Woodrow Wilson became one of the first political scientists in the United States. He was studied, took all his classes, and was working on his PhD when he got, in fact, a job offer from a college, a new school, literally opening its doors in Pennsylvania called Bryn Mawr College. And this was one of the few all-female colleges in the United States. This is in the 1880s. And Wilson became one of the very first professors, literally the day they opened Bryn Mawr College, Professor Woodrow Wilson was there to start teaching what we now call political science. He was teaching a little law, a little economics, a little history, and there it all was. He was not thrilled with this job. It was a job. It allowed him to marry Ellen. They had three daughters within a few years, but he was not that interested in teaching women, which was then something of a novelty, certainly at the college level. I should add that Mrs. Wilson was not that happy about his teaching just women either. And they both began looking around for another place where he might teach. And indeed, he found another job at Wesleyan College in Connecticut. And after a few years of being content, but not much more than that, he got the one call he hoped he might get if he was going to remain in academia, and that was a return to his alma mater. He was offered a job at Princeton. And Wilson returned to Princeton in 1890. So now it's just a decade after he's graduated, and now he is a young professor there. It was very exciting for him. And over the next 12 years, this man reformed the way we think about education, and he took the campus by storm, in fact. Once again, he had his fingers everywhere, every club, everything. He was the faculty advisor. He became the most popular professor on campus overnight. He was a dazzling lecturer. He was writing a dozen books. It was an extremely productive time for him, such that by 1902, this is now he's been there 12 years, the trustees of the university realized this man should be our president, that is, president of Princeton. And they unanimously made him that, and they basically kicked out the existing president, who was an amiable fellow but used to boast that he ran the finest country club in America. And he did. He was proud of it. The trustees were thinking maybe we ought to be something a little more than a really good country club. And that's where Wilson came in. And now, starting in 1902 and over the next 8 years, Woodrow Wilson not only reformed education at Princeton, and let me reuse that word, he not only reformed education, he reformed education in the United States in such a way that we feel it today. And if you went to a college or know somebody who went to a college in which you majored in something, in which there was a sequence of courses within your major, in which maybe you took some electives to complement your major, in which you attended two lectures a week and then maybe broke into a small class with perhaps a young professor or a teaching assistant, maybe you had an honor code even, then you studied under the Wilsonian method. All those are the elements of what Wilson brought to college education, which was something quite other than that before he got hold of Princeton. And he instituted those changes there, and indeed they became adopted. And to this day, there's hardly a school, certainly in this country, that doesn't function along that particular pattern. So there he was, just making inroads everywhere, changing things everywhere. And now he wanted to get to the really big change. And that was, this is going to be another one of those personal threads. You know, Princeton was a country club. it was sort of a private enclave for the sons of the, not just the rich, but the very rich in this country. And Wilson was always, even though he was active in everything, he was a bit of an outsider everywhere, especially when it came to the social life, the very exclusive eating clubs that they had at Princeton. And he was never quite accepted everywhere. He was admired, but he was not really invited into the prestigious clubs. So now Woodrow Wilson is running the place, and this is something he really wants to change. And he sets out to do it in a number of ways to break up this social system. And in doing that, and this is quite remarkable, he began to gather national attention because he was giving speeches not just on the campus and in New Jersey and at other campuses, but starting to go all around the country talking mostly about education. But he was using the college campus, you see, as a metaphor for America and all its potential. And he talked about how education should be the great tool every American, even a poor Presbyterian minister's son, could use to elevate himself. And so people began to catch on, and they thought, gee, here's Wilson fighting this club system at this country club called Princeton. And the New York Times is writing editorials about Woodrow Wilson, saying, listen to this man's message, not just you, Princeton, but everyone should know this message, because this is a message about education in America. It's quite something. Now, that was all well and good, except the trustees of Princeton, they thought Wilson had gone just far enough. Time for a time out here. And they loved all the educational reforms, but they sort of liked the way Princeton worked. They liked this club system. They liked all that. They liked the social exclusivity. And they were about to give Wilson the boot. And he began to look around for what he might be doing for the rest of his life. And then the answer sort of fell from above. And it was this. In 1910, if you can imagine this, the state of New Jersey, you got to grasp this with me, was considered the most corrupt state in the Union. Okay? Now work on it. I know it's a jaw dropper. It's just a jaw dropper. But there it is. And the reason it was that is because it was run by, if you can imagine this, the most corrupt political machine in America, which was the Democratic Party's machine in Jersey. It was so corrupt that even the leaders of it knew how corrupt it was, and they said to themselves in 1910, we've got to clean up our act, at least cosmetically. And here's what they thought. They said, what we really need is a puppet. We need to find the cleanest guy in the state of New Jersey. We will run him, and we'll do what we want. You know, we'll make him our face man, basically. And they thought and they thought and they said, what about that professor who runs Princeton, who writes all these political articles, talks about social exclusion, sounds kind of progressive, sounds great, he's perfect, doesn't have a blemish on him, let's run him. So they went to President Wilson of Princeton and they said, would you like to be the Democratic nominee for governor, because we have ways of making that happen. And indeed they did, and indeed he did. He accepted the offer, he ran, he won in a landslide. I mean, it was a landslide. And the first thing he did as governor, he's now taking office in 1911, the very first thing he did was kick out the machine. And I mean, physically, he barred them from entering state buildings. And now the entire country is looking toward New Jersey and saying, who is this man who broke the New Jersey machine in a month? It was extraordinary. And then, as if that wasn't enough, over the next year and a half, Wilson introduced and pushed through the most progressive agenda in this country of any state, hands down. And now, not only is everybody in the country looking at New Jersey, but the Democratic Party in particular on the national level, which has lost election after election, realizing it needs a new party leader, is now looking at Woodrow Wilson very carefully. And now here begins, well, what I call, and here's another bullet point for you, the most meteoric rise in American history. And run with me on this for 1 second. In October of 1910, Woodrow Wilson was the president of a small college in New Jersey. October of 1910. November of 1912, he's elected president of the United States. Never been anything like it. I can't imagine there ever will be anything like it. It's extraordinary. He got elected in one of the most exciting races in American history, 1912, when he ran against the incumbent president, William Howard Taft, a Republican. He ran against Theodore Roosevelt, a former president who bolted from the Republican Party because he didn't like what Taft was doing with it and started the Progressive Bull Moose Party. And then just to make this election a little more colorful, just a little pepper on top of it, Eugene Debs, the great socialist, also ran as a fourth party candidate. So we have this wonderful four-way race. Debs was never going to win, but he was really an interesting part of the entire election. Well, Wilson won the election. Electorally, it was the greatest electoral college victory in the history of the United States up to that date. It was a huge, huge landslide. Obviously, the Republicans split a lot of the popular vote, and the Democrat, Wilson, coasted through. And now, Wilson is president of the United States. Exactly 100 years ago this year, he was inaugurated. He came in, again, not only with the most progressive agenda that any president, even Teddy Roosevelt, ever had to that date, but he also got it passed. And within months, and certainly within the first 2 or 3 years, Wilson came in running on something he had called the New Freedom. And he came in immediately with tariff reform, introduced the modern income tax, a progressive income tax that would really equalize things, redistribute wealth, if you will. He instituted, well, this couldn't be timelier, it's today, the Federal Reserve System. This is something Wilson brought to the United States and instituted it. The 8-hour workday, workman's compensation. He put the first Jew on the Supreme Court. I mean, there were 25 major progressive issues that he turned into law within a few years. That in and of itself is a major accomplishment. But something even more enduring that he did at this time was that he changed the role of the president, and he changed the way the president acted, the way a president could serve. Until then, Teddy Roosevelt had made a few dents in this armor, but the country by the 1910, 1912 was very lopsided in its government. It was really run by the Congress. A fairly corrupt Congress at that. The presidency was very, very weak. Wilson felt they should be equalized. He, being a constitutional scholar and a political scientist with a PhD, our only president with a PhD, by the way, on top of his law degree, Wilson believed that he knew that the role of the president is the least defined in the Constitution. It says almost nothing about what the president does. He interpreted that as meaning the president can do anything he wants until somebody tells him he can't, and that would be either the Congress or the Supreme Court. So Wilson just plowed ahead with one measure after another. But it wasn't just the measures. It was the way in which he presented them. And here's where I think he got awfully clever and creative, and where once again, well, it's hard for me to read the newspaper today without thinking of Woodrow Wilson. And here's the reason. He changed the way presidents related to Congress. Wilson had this really, well, this is, again, a really peculiar notion. Wilson believed that the executive branch, the White House, and the legislative branch, Congress, are you ready? He believed these two branches should cooperate. Now, I mean this quite literally. He believed they should cooperate the government. And so for that reason, Wilson did something no president had done for more than a century. He began showing up in Congress. We have a big ritual once a year. The president comes in, gives a State of the Union address. Everybody gathers, hear ye, you know, all welcome. Everybody rise for the president. They do, and they applaud, and it's great. No president had done that since John Adams in 1800. Wilson brought this tradition back. He wanted to humanize the White House. He wanted to put a face on his presidency. He wanted the Congress to know they were there to work with each other. So he showed up not just for State of the Union speeches. He called 25 joint sessions of Congress. Every time he had a measure he wanted to present, he'd call the whole Congress together in the summer sometimes in Washington. They all had to gather. And he would come in and say, I think we should have an 8-hour workday, or we need, you know, this new income tax. Whatever it was, Wilson would show up. Now, if you take all the joint sessions of all the other presidents and add them up, taking away the popular State of the Union address, they don't come close to Wilson's 25 joint sessions. It was extraordinary. But that was the least of what he did. He would then show up the next day, and the day after that, and the day after that, and he would sit in the most beautiful room in the Congress. There is a room that sits right off of the Senate floor. Now, most people in the Congress don't even know this room exists. It is, I truly believe, the most beautiful room in the Congress. It's rather small. It's not even the size of this seating area, just of the chairs here. High ceiling, though, beautiful tile walls, frescoes. It's a magnificent room. But it is locked up. It is, to this day, it is locked. There is only one president who has ever used it, and that's Woodrow Wilson. Now, part of the reason nobody's used it, I think, is it has a kind of tricky name, which is, it's called the President's Room. And it just sits there, locked. And George Washington conceived this room when they were building the Capitol. He said, make a room where the president can just come and do business and literally grab legislators when they walk out of the, you know, off the floor. And that is what Wilson did. And in so doing, he became enormously effective. And what he had, you see, and one wishes all presidents, especially today, would be mindful of this, of having a sustained dialogue rather than sort of lurching from crisis to crisis, of having an ongoing conversation, not only with your Congress, but with your countrymen. And that is what Wilson did. And for his first term, that conversation was largely domestic issues. Two cataclysms. The first is that his beloved wife, Ellen, the thousands of passionate love letters, died 1 year into his office. She died in the White House. The president was devastated. I mean, this was a man of great passion. He could barely get out of bed. He sank into a deep clinical depression. He talked about resigning, and only one thing got him out of bed, and that was the second cataclysm, which was the week she died, war broke out in Europe, and duty pulled him out of bed. And he got to do it trying to figure out, well, first of all, trying to figure out if this war had to go on. if it even had to become a war, which it really didn't. But second, was there anything the United States could do to prevent this war from exploding? And actually, there was a third thing. What is the United States going to be doing about this war? And for several years, Wilson did everything humanly possible, everything diplomatically possible, to keep America out of the First World War. And indeed, he ran for re-election on the slogan, "He kept us out of war." By April of 1917, however, he was singing a new tune, because after 3 years of diplomacy, he realized the Germans were not getting any better. In fact, they were escalating their war. They were escalating their belligerence. They were stepping up their program of torpedoing ships, torpedoing neutral ships even if American citizens were on those ships. Hundreds of American souls went down, and they were not responding to Wilson's memorandums that he was sending off. And finally, it just became intolerable, and Wilson suggested, believed, we had to get into that war. And we did. And we did because he called a joint session of Congress and asked for a declaration of war. And in that declaration, on April 2nd, 1917, Woodrow Wilson uttered one sentence in this one speech. The speech, I think, is the most important foreign policy speech any president has delivered. The sentence is the foundation of all American foreign policy to this minute. And here's the line. "The world," said Wilson, "must be made safe for democracy." That's all it is. And 3 or 4 weeks ago, President Obama was talking about, well, it was Syria. 4 weeks ago, that was our crisis. And he gave a speech to the public, to the press, and he was saying, well, you know, I know we've had Iraq and Afghanistan and some, you know, are we the policemen of the world? But he was also saying, on the other hand, can we just sit there when there is a dictator who is killing, gassing his own people, that children are dying? Can the United States just look the other way? With greatness, does there not come some responsibility? And basically, Obama was suggesting what Wilson did in 1917, which is there must be a moral component to American foreign policy. And all that goes back to those Presbyterian churches in the South. And this was a Wilsonian notion, and every incursion we have had since, for good or for bad, and there's been plenty of bad. In Wilson's day, it was Mexico and Haiti, even. But Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, what do we do with Syria? All of those go directly back to the April 2nd, 1917 speech. The world must be made safe for democracy. That's it. He raised the moral issue. And so it has been our foundation ever since. It has been, it's really our identity. It's part of our DNA now. It's just been woven into our fabric. And there it is. Well, we went to war. Wilson proved to be a great commander-in-chief. He mobilized the greatest army that had ever been assembled in the world. We who had an army the size of that of Portugal, within a year had mustered an army of 2 million men and sent them overseas, over the Atlantic Ocean. This whole country mobilized. We really built what we now consider a military-industrial complex. But it was precisely that, and Wilson was doing it in 1917 and 1918. We won that war. And in so doing, and the main reason Wilson ultimately led us into the war, I think, was so that we, the victors, could dictate the peace. And he came up with 14 notions. He called them points. And these 14 points were how the world should be settled after the war. And most of them were sort of mechanical, but there was one that was pure idealism. And it was the reason Wilson led this nation into war. And that was the 14th point, which said there should be the establishment of something he called the League of Nations. And this was meant to be little more than a table at which every nation could sit and discuss matters before they blew up into wars. And that everybody would subscribe to certain rules of how nations, how a brotherhood of nations might function. And any violator of those rules will face not just one other country, they will face an entire league who will have a league army that you will be fighting. And that was meant, as Wilson said, to allow the war we had just fought to be the war to end all wars. Made perfect sense to him. The President of the United States, Wilson, when he went over to work out this treaty, was gone for 6 months. For 6 months, he left the country, hammered it out, came home with the treaty, the League is in hand. He comes back to an extremely hostile Senate who must ratify the treaty. And indeed, if you can imagine this, I found some, going through some Franklin Roosevelt papers, actually, in which he alluded to the fact, get ready for this, that while he was gone during those 6 months, the Republicans were holding secret meetings saying, whatever Wilson brings back, we're against it. We don't care what it is, we're against it. Can you imagine such a thing? And there it was. And he came back. He realized they were against it. He wasn't going to get his treaty. He wasn't going to get his 14 points. So Wilson did something extraordinary. He got on a train, and he embarked on a 29-city tour around this country, selling his heart out. Sometimes 5 speeches a day in the dead of summer in 1919. And it was so horrible. I mean, it was so onerous, it was so difficult, that 2/3 of the way through the trip, in fact, he had just been to Denver and he had passed through Pueblo, Colorado. And after the speech in Pueblo, he collapsed. And the doctor, who had not revealed the full extent of his patient's arteriosclerosis to his patient, that is one Dr. Grayson, to his patient Woodrow Wilson, said, Mr. President, this tour is over. And Wilson refused and said, no, no, they'll think I'm a quitter. And he said, the tour is over. They rushed him back to the White House. And 3 days later, Wilson suffered a stroke. And now the story gets really good. Because as I suggest in the book, I don't suggest it, I say it. What then occurred is what I consider the greatest conspiracy in White House history. Because the second Mrs. Wilson, yes, after the first Mrs. Wilson died, Woodrow Wilson met an attractive young widow in Washington. He began courting her in the White House. He began writing hundreds of the most passionate love letters you have ever read. I mean, these made the other ones look sick, because now he's in his 50s. You know, he's really got to pour it on. And he does. He wins, and he marries her. And they have this intensely romantic marriage. But now this wife, the second Mrs. Wilson, Edith, and a few doctors make a decision, and that decision is they will tell nobody that the President of the United States had a stroke. And he is locked up in the bedroom, basically. Now, he did not lose his power of speech or reasoning, but he was paralyzed on one side. His emotions were wild. I mean, really wild mood swings, as often accompany strokes. And his judgment was often impaired. But that didn't matter, because nobody, for the next year and a half, saw the President of the United States without at least going through Mrs. Wilson. She determined who got to see the President and what was revealed to that person. The paperwork you know, there's endless paperwork running a country. No document that needed a signature, no appointment, no memorandum, nothing that had to pass before the president did, unless Mrs. Wilson, out of the thousands of pages that would come into the office every day, she would determine what few pages he would even look at. She would then discuss the issues with him, and he would come out with what he said it should be or shouldn't be, or not, as you will see. It's quite detailed in the book, actually, what she did and what she didn't do. But in the end, it has been argued, and one could make this argument, that Mrs. Wilson was the first female president of this country, because it is a certainty that the executive branch of this country was run day to day by her. That simple. And so it is. He hobbled out of the White House, the lamest duck who ever left the presidency. And Wilson and his wife actually became the only president to remain in Washington after serving in the White House. And they lived in a very nice but somewhat modest house in Washington. And there, over the next 3 years, Wilson just faded away, really, mentally and physically and emotionally. Except for this. His successor was Warren G. Harding, who is famously the most corrupt president we've ever had. Even before he died in office, which he did, and the real corruption surfaced, he was just a man of very loose morals, and personally and professionally. And suddenly there was a longing for Woodrow Wilson. And every day, Wilson would go out for a drive, and on any given afternoon, there'd be 10 or 15 people standing outside his house in Washington just to get a look at him. And then over the months, there'd be 20 people, 30 people, sometimes 50 people. On November 11th of 1921, the first anniversary that the Wilsons were out of the White House, that Veterans Day, you know, the armistice of World War I was being celebrated, there were 1,000 people there. And the next year, 10,000 people. The next year, 20,000 people flocked to Woodrow Wilson's house, maybe to get a glimpse of him at the window, maybe just to see him going in the car, whatever it was. He had become, you see, he'd become an icon. He'd become a symbol internationally of peace and freedom, and ultimately idealism. We are not put into this world to sit still and know, said Woodrow Wilson. We are put into it to act. Well, I hope each of you will take a few minutes to sit still, I hope with my book, so you can know a little more about Woodrow Wilson. And then I hope you'll act. And the action is, this is a man who was considered the savior of the world 100 years ago. He was for decades considered one of the four, maybe five greatest presidents who ever served. And now he has faded considerably for all sorts of reasons that are enumerated in the book and we can talk about in the next few minutes. But in any case, I think the world should know about him. You can like him or you can dislike him. But you must realize we live in a world today that is almost completely of Woodrow Wilson's making. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thanks. Thank you, thank you. Now, I kept you after school, but I'd be happy to take a question or two from you if you like, if anybody has them. If not, sure.
I've always been curious with this.
I'm so glad you asked this, because obviously this would take it. Yes, but so it should be there. This most progressive man, when it came to racial matters, was also the most regressive man when it came to civil rights. So your question, asking how someone so progressive could be so regressive when it comes to civil rights, it is just, well, it's somewhat complicated but very simple in the end, and it means going back to my first thread here. This is somebody, a president, who was born in the Deep South, was raised in four Confederate states during the Civil War and Reconstruction. He grew up in a society that worked very well, at least if you were a white person. And it wasn't just the economy, it was an entire society that was built on, well, not just slavery, but on segregation, that there were two different worlds there, two different Americas there. And so it was. Now, that's only part of the explanation. Now, it's a big part, and it's something I have a difficult time trying to explain to young people today, a century later, that segregation even existed. I mean, here we have a biracial president, and they can't understand, how can this possibly be? How could it have existed? Well, it did for several hundred years, and again, it worked for most of the country. But there's more to it than that. Wilson, because he was so Southern, he was not a virulent racist. I call him in the book a genteel racist. He did believe in segregation then. He often talked about integrating the country, but he also often said, it's going to take a generation or two, he said, before this country is ready for it. He used to say, there's one part of the country nobody needs to explain to me, and that's the South. So while he was ready to consider integration, he knew his Southern brethren was not ready to do it. And what little integration there had been, it had really brought about a lot of conflict and a lot of blood, actually. Now, again, it's hard for people today to remember lynching was a part of, well, I was going to say the American way of life. It was certainly a part of way of life in the South. There were two lynchings a week. It was just a regular practice, and nobody said much down there. And this is small potatoes, but Wilson, strangely, was the first president to say lynching should be illegal. Huh? What? Yes. I mean, but this was a big deal when it happened. So in the end, though, taking away presentism, taking away 2013 values and trying to apply them to 1913, I think there were two motivating things behind Wilson's racism. The first was he really did not believe integration that the country was ready for integration. And I saw it in enough of his papers in which he was attacked by both sides. He had a lot of people, especially in the North, saying it's time to start integrating this country. And he'd say, I'm doing the best I can down here, but I have a third of my Congress is Southern. And then he heard from a lot of Southerners who said, why are you still appointing black judges? You know, one of the reasons we made you president, said a lot of Southern people, was so there would be no more black judges or people appointed to jobs in the Treasury Department who were black. And don't you understand that means someday a white woman is going to have to work under a black man? And Wilson is writing back to them saying, you don't understand, you know, the world is changing. So he was pulled both ways. That's one thing. The second thing, and I just made a slight reference to it, a third of the Congress was Southern, and they were solidly Democratic. And Wilson had this very progressive political agenda. And the Southerners made it very clear to him in day one, if you start integrating this country, your new freedom is going nowhere. And so, as I say in the book, the new freedom, which really did pass, was really passed on the backs of the African American. And I do believe that. Does that answer your question? Good. Yes, sir.
So what did Congress think of the president coming in and, like, really wanting to have a say every day?
Well, at first, the question is, what did Congress think of Wilson coming in and starting to have this conversation, basically? Well, at first, they didn't think too much of it. In fact, even Wilson's party members, even the Democrats, thought, well, what is going on here? I mean, does he think he's a monarch? You know, does he think he can just come in and give throne speeches whenever he wants? But then they realized, even they, the Democrats, and even the Republicans began to see, well, there is a dialogue going on here. So it took a while, but it reached a point, and then it sort of entered the joke phase. Well, oh, he's coming back again. But then it reached the point where everybody realized, this is a way that this machine really can work. And indeed, even toward the later part of Wilson's presidency, when he was pushing for his League of Nations that he did not get past a Republican Congress. Even then, however, the dialogue kept going, and they didn't resist his wanting to have a conversation with them. And in fact, so intent was Wilson on maintaining this dialogue, not only did he go to Congress, he called for, this is crazy, it's never happened, and probably never will happen, he called for a meeting of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He said, why don't you have the meeting here at the White House? I mean, this was just craziness. But they did it. And they all met in the East Room, and then he served them all lunch, you know, and as somebody pointed out, it was a $5 lunch. It was a really good lunch, you know, five courses and the whole thing. But it became a part of life, and government really functioned well. You know, don't forget, Wilson brought us through the greatest catastrophe, this world war, that not just the country, but the world had ever seen. I mean, this was the first time an entire world had really gone to war. And this nation became very strong as a result of it. We really became the United States after that war. We became, well, whether you like it or not, we became the first modern superpower as a result of that war. We were it. The rest of the world was really in shambles. And there we stood. I mean, we proudly, you know, swept up the mess. Anything else before I let you go into the night, sir?
Yeah, you touched on it briefly, but I just wanted to hear your thoughts. What role do you think religion played in Wilson's life, you know, politics, and in his personal life?
Well, the question is, what role did religion play in Wilson's life, and how does that translate? Well, needless to say, in my book, you will see it translated all the time. Again, the two threads. You know, I think the personal life of who he was is inseparable from what he did. And you will see in the book also that every chapter title has a religious connotation, and I start off each chapter with a bit of the Bible, with a piece of scripture, quite literally, that I know Wilson was reading, or I truly believe he was reading, and if nothing else, it gives you a sense of what was going on in his head. At the end of the day, it is Woodrow Wilson's personal morality that really imprints, to this day, American foreign policy, for example, or even his domestic policy of this leveling of the playing field, which is what runs throughout all his actions, whether he was president of Princeton or whether he was president of the United States. And all that, you see, I believe, goes back to this little boy sitting in the churches in the South listening to his father give these sermons. And in fact, you will also see in the book, I'll go farther back than that. I'll take you back to Martin Luther and the beginning of Protestantism. And I can get away with that because when Woodrow Wilson gives his great speech, "The World Must Be Made Safe for Democracy," the last line of it, he summons Martin Luther. I mean, he virtually quotes him, he paraphrases him in the last line of the speech. And it's kind of breathtaking. And you realize, as I also put out there for you, that Presbyterianism, its roots really combine. When John Knox goes back to Scotland in the 1500s, he weds not just religion with education, but also with politics. And the Scots Presbyterians were extremely political, extremely political. That was part of who they were. And they were fighting the British. They were fighting the Redcoats. And indeed, that's why so many of our early presidents were, in fact, Scots-Irish or Presbyterians. That was in their blood, and part of it in their blood was fighting the bloody British. You know, they just didn't like them. So the answer is a great deal. Wilson's personal religion and his, beyond that, his spirituality, his morality, to this day dictates the very questions we're talking about. Sir?
Yeah. Is there evidence that perhaps FDR was also influenced in his progressivism by Wilson?
The question is whether FDR was influenced in his progressivism by Woodrow Wilson's. There is so much evidence, and in fact, FDR becomes almost a leitmotif in my book, and it ends, in fact, the book really ends, you virtually see the torch being passed to Franklin Roosevelt, who idolized Woodrow Wilson. Franklin Roosevelt's first job on a national level was serving as Woodrow Wilson's Undersecretary of the Navy. When Woodrow Wilson went to Paris for those 6 months, he took a team of players with him, including Franklin Roosevelt. When Franklin Roosevelt first ran for national office, it was in 1920, running as vice president with Governor Cox of Ohio, and they lost to Warren Harding and Calvin Coolidge. But Franklin Roosevelt, most people forget, ran for vice president and lost in 1920. And the first thing he did when he was nominated was he went to the Wilson White House for Woodrow Wilson's blessing. And Wilson had had his stroke by then. And it's very ironic and really fascinating for me, the biographer, because I know how Roosevelt ends, but this meeting, what moved Roosevelt most, I mean, he actually started to cry when he saw Wilson for the first time, because Wilson has had his stroke. He's in a wheelchair. He's got his left side covered in blankets so as not really to draw attention to the paralysis and all that. And now, in retrospect, and this isn't just me trying to make more of it, you can see him clocking everything that Wilson does. Now, Franklin Roosevelt was fully able-bodied and 6'2½", you know, at this point. But when you then realize what happened to FDR, and I certainly realize that the image we have of FDR with a head cocked back and the hat on and never letting him see you down and, you know, the jaunty expression and all that, he took that all from Woodrow Wilson, you see. So the influence... Now, then you get into the policy. The New Deal is basically, it's based on the new freedom. I mean, it gets bigger, it blossoms, but all the seeds of the new freedom are planted by Woodrow Wilson, every one of them. And then, of course, as a warrior, World War II really was just, you know, World War I Part II. So the influence of Wilson on Franklin Roosevelt is almost infinite. And FDR really worshipped him.
That's wonderful. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. It's an interesting part of the story. And it truly intrigued me. And I found myself having to cut back. And I kept telling myself, you're not writing about Franklin Roosevelt. You're writing about you're writing about Woodrow Wilson, you know. So lay that out. With that, I thank you very much for being here tonight.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.